Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 1st of August, these are our main stories. The United States has imposed sanctions on the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. The US media are quoting intelligence sources as saying that Hamza bin Laden, the 30-year-old son of the late Al-Qaeda leader, is dead. The deadliest outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has killed a second person in a densely populated city on the border with Rwanda. Also in this podcast, the sounds of the Señorita of the Sea, the tiny vaquita porpoise. But with 10 left in the wild, can the species be saved? The United States has imposed sanctions on the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. The sanctions freeze any assets of Mr. Zarif in the United States or controlled by US entities. I heard more from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
This is about Javad Zarif, who has already dismissed the idea that these are important simply because he says he has no property or interests outside Iran. Whether that's true or not, though, it is about sending a signal to Iran and Mr. Zarif himself. There has certainly been frustration at the way he is being used as an individual to speak on behalf of the Iranian government. For example, they've called him a propaganda minister rather than acting as a foreign minister. And certainly, if you take a listen to Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State last weekend, he was saying he would like to speak to the Iranian public the way that Javad Zarif has a chance to come and speak to the American public. He feels that really there has been a different idea of what has been getting across, simply the idea that the Iranians are pushing propaganda and ultimately they want to be able to try and push back against that. At the same time, though, it's clear that Mr. Zarif will still be able to travel to New York in order to attend the UN, to conduct that kind of business there. And ultimately, therefore, you might ask whether or not these are effective in tackling the concerns that the US have.
OK, Chris. Well, let's go on to an unrelated matter. There are reports coming out of the media in the United States that Osama bin Laden's son, Hamza, is dead. What do we know about that? It's spare details at the moment, but if it was to be true, how significant a figure is Hamza?
Well, we've been waiting for official word from the Pentagon. Certainly US media reports are saying that they have got military sources who have confirmed that the Pentagon now does have confirmation that Hamza bin Laden is dead. And he is a figure who they have been concerned about in recent months. In fact, recently, about 5 months ago, they offered $1 million reward for information that would lead to his capture. And that's because at the time they said he was emerging as a key figure in the leadership of modern Al-Qaeda. And specifically, he had apparently released audio and video messages in which he had called for attacks on America and its allies in revenge for the killing of his father, Osama bin Laden, who, of course, helped plan the notorious 9/11 attacks. And indeed, when he was tracked down and killed by US Special Forces in 2011, after a 10-year search at the compound in Pakistan where he was found, they actually discovered letters which were apparently written by bin Laden. And even then, apparently, he said he was grooming his son to succeed him.
Chris Buckler. The US Federal Reserve has cut its key interest rate for the first time since 2008. The American Central Bank said the rate would be lowered by 0.25%. Supporters say it will give a boost to the US economy. At a news conference, the Fed's chairman, Jerome Powell, denied the Fed was giving in to pressure from President Trump for a rate cut.
The outlook for the US economy remains favorable, and this action is designed to support that outlook. It is intended to insure against downside risks from weak global growth and trade policy uncertainty, to help offset the effects these factors are currently having on the economy, and to promote a faster return of inflation to our symmetric 2% objective. All of these objectives will support achievement of our overarching goal to sustain the expansion with a strong job market and inflation close to our objective for the benefit of the American people.
In a tweet, President Trump said he hoped the Fed's move was the beginning of a lengthy and aggressive rate-cutting cycle. Michelle Fleury in New York explains more about the cut in the key interest rate.
If you look at the domestic economy, it seems a bit puzzling. Why are you cutting rates when things look fairly rosy and the economy is growing? The answer is when you start looking further afield. Those inside the Federal Reserve are concerned about a weakening global picture. They're worried about the implications of trade disputes, how that is impacting American businesses. If you look at the growth figures that were released last week, you may recall that we started to see a pullback in the amount American companies were willing to invest. They are nervous about what the implications of this trade dispute will be. And the third thing is that inflation remains low. And so the Fed felt that they had room to make this cut to try and boost inflation.
Michel Fleury in New York. A second person has died of Ebola in a bustling city on the border between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Health officials say they're extremely concerned that the virus could spread across the region. The latest victim, a miner from the town of Ituri, was already in a critical condition when he was isolated in an Ebola treatment centre in Goma on Tuesday. He'd been showing symptoms for a week. Earlier this month, a priest died from the virus in the same city, which has a population of more than a million people. Newly published figures show the outbreak has killed over 1,800 people since it began a year ago. Hebdavi Muhindo is program director for the relief agency Tear Fund. He's Congolese and is currently in Goma.
There is a sense of general panic at the city at the moment, as I think the city was not yet fully prepared. Now, there is a lot of work that has been done. Tear Fund, for example, is working hard with faith leaders to mobilize people to create awareness about the disease so that people can get the message through a trusted source. However, Goma is a city of between a million to 2 million people. And therefore, the work that has been done had not yet been sufficient to reach everybody that needs to be reached so that they can be able to know what to do when the virus hits.
What do we know about this second case? On the surface, it appears to be unrelated to the first fatality, which was that of a priest. And I guess that is a worrying development.
That is a worrying development because the case is not, as you said, so far the information that is available is that this case is not related to the previous one of the pastor who came from up north. This case also came from up north. But it came when it got into the city, it could not be detected because there were no symptoms yet. So it was still the incubation period. So they were not able to catch it at the entry point. However, the symptoms started developing while the person was already in the city. And that's where it's important that the city of Goma, even the health clinics and the general population are made aware through the right sources to know what are the symptoms, to know what to do in case you are feeling these symptoms and where to seek medical help.
What is being done to check people coming into the city?
There is screening at the cities. They do check basically what is the most common symptom, which is checking the temperature, because high fever is one of the earliest signs of the disease. So there is checks to record who is coming in, where they are coming from, and if you have been in contact with anybody who had Ebola before.
So you're talking to people or you're talking to the faith groups, getting them to spread the message of awareness, but also of making sure that if you have any suspicion that you have symptoms, even if you're not showing anything, you need to get checked out.
That is correct. First of all, making sure people know what are the signs and that if you suspect anything, seek medical help from the right place. Don't hide. But the sooner you seek medical help, the better. The other thing is focusing as well on making sure that people are actually changing their social norms and their social behavior. For example, in Goma already, we're encouraging people, wash your hands as many times as possible. Avoid direct contact, body contact. It's a bit difficult to change your way of life. Suddenly you're meeting someone, you meet your grandmother and she wants to hug you and you have to say, sorry, grandma, I can't hug you. Now, the second aspect is making sure that the many clinics in Goma are ready and prepared.
Well, what is the situation at the moment? Is the infrastructure there?
As Tear Fund ourselves, we are working in a number of clinics in Goma to make sure they are ready, putting in the infrastructure, the water, the latrine, the isolation units, even mobilizing the people working at the clinic so they know and they can quickly detect.
The WHO declared Ebola a global emergency on the 17th of this month. Have you seen any tangible impact of that decision?
As of now, not yet. There is actually a fear that there could be blockages in travel, which could frustrate people even more because of that declaration.
So just to be clear, do you mean that people are more worried, are taking to the roads, trying to get out? What exactly do you mean by that?
A city like Goma, it's a business city. There is a lot of traffic with tens of thousands of people crossing the border to Rwanda and Uganda every day. So there is that worry because people are crossing the borders, that if the borders decide to shut down, then what happens to their livelihood? However, we are still waiting at the same time for the effect of it in terms of resources to be mobilized. So because it's only been 2 weeks, we are hopeful that in the coming days, there will be more resources available. It is time to act. I know there is some donor fatigue because this is not the only crisis that is in DRC. There is already other problems. There is insecurity. There is displacement. However, there should not be a fatigue. For this Ebola, there needs to be resources. The world needs to react to this. The world needs to mobilize for this, to stop this disease.
Hebdavi Muhindo speaking to James Kumarasamy. Over 5,000 migrants and refugees are currently being detained in Libya by the country's Department for the Control of Illegal Migration. Many of them are there after being intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard when trying to cross to Europe by boat. The conditions in the detention centres have widely been described as degrading and inhumane. But what of the response of the international community? Well, a BBC investigation has uncovered criticism of the United Nations agencies tasked with offering solutions to migrants and refugees trapped in Libya. In this special report, our North Africa correspondent, Rana Jawad, looks at the support given to the Libyan Coast Guard.
Life in Libya's detention centres often starts at sea. Leila, not her real name, is just one of several refugees I've spoken to during this investigation. Her words are spoken by an actor to protect her identity.
There were about 140 people on the blow-up boat. I was so happy. Of course I was praying we would get to safety, but I knew the worst thing that could happen was only death, and that was a better option than Libya. Then we ran out of fuel, and the Libyan Coast Guard found us, and they forced us to get on their boat.
Leila will be rescued by the abusive Libyan Coast Guard and taken back to a country where she is facing violations of her human rights.
Giulia Trancini is an immigration lawyer based in London. She's in constant touch with trapped refugees. She says returning migrants to Libya is in breach of the international principle known as non-refoulement.
No person should be returned to a country where they will face torture, cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, or other irreparable harm, as this will be the case.
The European Union provides training and equipment to the Libyan Coast Guards, but some NGOs accuse the European bloc of using the Libyans to carry out their border management away from EU shores. Leila and her husband, Mohammed, also not his real name, were met by staff from the refugee agency UNHCR and its sister agency, the IOM, when they docked in Tripoli. These two agencies are heavily involved with the work of the Libyan Coast Guard. They receive money from the EU to carry out training and to buy the Coast Guard equipment. For many we spoke to, this compromises their humanitarian mission. Catherine, not her real name, worked in Libya's humanitarian sector. She asked us to hide her identity for fear of professional repercussions. Her words are read by an actor.
They work together with the European Union to ensure that the so-called migration problem is not coming to Europe. This is the aim of the EU, and I think that these agencies are the implementers of that on the ground.
In response to our investigation, the UNHCR told us their work with the Coast Guard is to ensure that lives are not lost at sea. And the IOM said they provided training to the Libyan Coast Guard in human rights and first aid. But for many human rights observers, the main concern is that after being returned to Libyan shores, refugees and migrants are then taken to detention centres. Here's Leila again.
I was locked in a small room with 50 other women and just a bucket for a toilet. So many people were sick with tuberculosis. Some of them died in my arms. I was beaten up and we were tortured with electricity.
I asked the UNHCR head of Libya mission, Jean-Paul Cavalieri, why he felt they needed to be present when people are brought back by the Coast Guard.
We have a first chance to at least count and mark and get names and nationalities. I don't think that being at this demarcation point is participating into criminal mechanisms or being accomplice of something that is just giving us an opportunity to be there at a point where we may have a chance to protect people.
But you're essentially reduced to being an organization that distributes non-food items, is essentially a witness at disembarkation points where migrants and refugees are being returned and then put into detention centers. Then what is the purpose of UNHCR?
I would not say that UNHCR is reduced to distributing items. Nearly 5,000 persons have been resettled abroad
since
over the past
year?
Few years, since November 2017.
Leila and her husband stayed in detention for months, hoping for evacuation by the UN, but their hopes dwindled.
Some time passed, and we were told it was going to be our turn to leave next. Mohammed asked me to go check, but our names weren't there. I had to tell him that we had been passed over again. So many people who came in after us had already left. Mohammed was so upset and confused. I saw Mohammed being taken away. It was the last time I ever saw him. I was later told he had covered himself in petrol and set himself on fire.
This shocking case brings up many of the issues highlighted by other refugees and migrants I've spoken to since, many of whom are desperate and losing hope.
That report by Rana Jawad. Now, in response to the investigation, a EU spokesperson denied that it supports the Libyan Coast Guard in order to outsource border management, adding that they work with international partners to manage international migration, protect migrants' human rights, prevent perilous irregular journeys exploited by illegal human traffickers, and to ensure opportunities for legal and safe pathways. You can read more about Rana's investigation at bbcafrica.com. Now, to the balmy waters of the Sea of Cortez off Mexico and the rare vaquita porpoise. According to the Royal Society in London, the marine mammal could be extinct within a year. Beth Timmins has more.
This is the sound of the so-called señorita of the sea, the vaquita porpoise. But scientists are warning it is heading towards extinction. There are only around 10 of them left, and one of the authors of the study, Professor Len Thomas, says that the species could become extinct within the year due to illegal fishing with gill nets.
They're designed to catch the gills of the fish. As the fish swim through them, they get caught up in them. But unfortunately, they're sort of somewhat invisible to the porpoise's echolocation system, and the porpoise also get caught up in them. And being an air-breathing mammal, they get drowned in them.
The gill nets were banned by the Mexican government back in 2015, but their use continues. That's because of the demand for the bladder of the Totaba fish. These sell for tens of thousands of dollars in the Chinese medicine market. As the illegal fishing goes on, more and more porpoise are caught at the same time. The Mexican Navy and the Sea Shepherd Organization are still patrolling the Sea of Cortez to try to enforce the ban. Professor Thomas says hope is not yet lost.
If we can stop the killing, then the species may be able to recover, and there's a good chance of that. It can't stand any more deaths, and so the enforcement action needs to be totally effective, and that needs to be right away, needs to happen now.
Other critically endangered species, such as the whooping crane, the blackfoot ferret, and the blue iguana, have been brought back from the brink of extinction. But as the vaquita's population has dwindled so rapidly, scientists say much more needs to be done to save these señoritas of the sea.
Beth Timmins reporting. Now, here are some furred, feathered and finned creatures that might be able to teach us a thing or two.
How do geckos walk up walls and across ceilings? How do beetles survive in one of the most arid places in the world? And how do humpback whales power their enormous bodies through the sea? I'm Patrick Ai, and those are some of the questions I've been answering in my podcast, 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter. But the answers are actually just the beginning. The podcast is about biomimicry, solutions to human challenges that have been inspired by nature, like how the gecko's feet might help us grab hold of space debris, how beetles are teaching us better ways to collect water, and how the bumps on humpback whales' fins could make wind turbines more efficient. In every one of our short episodes, we look at a new animal and a new solution. There's lots for you to explore already and plenty more on the way. That's 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service. Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.
Boris Johnson's first visit to Northern Ireland as Britain's Prime Minister has been dominated by warnings from Irish nationalists against a no-deal Brexit. Mary Lou MacDonald of Sinn Féin, one of the five parties he met, said Mr Johnson was setting a very dangerous course. A hard border could be reinstated in Ireland if Britain leaves the European Union in 3 months without a deal. Mr Johnson's ally, Arlene Foster, said no deal was on the table only because a belligerent EU had wanted to break up the United Kingdom. Her Democratic Unionists give Britain's governing Conservatives a parliamentary majority. So what exactly is at stake? Someone who has negotiated closely with EU leaders and was at the heart of the British government under a former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, is Jonathan Powell. He was Mr Blair's chief of staff and one of the architects of the Northern Ireland peace agreement, known as the Good Friday Agreement. James Kumarasamy asked him if the possibility of a no-deal Brexit would make a referendum on a united Ireland more likely.
I don't think it's likely that a British government will call a border poll in the foreseeable future because the numbers simply aren't there for it yet. That said, it has the impact of Brexit has been to change public opinion in Northern Ireland. Traditionally, about a third of Catholic voters in Northern Ireland have favoured staying in the United Kingdom over joining United Ireland. Now that has changed. It's gone down by two-thirds to just 10% of those voters who favour staying in the United Kingdom. And even on the Protestant side of the divide, there are now many more people talking about, wouldn't we be better off inside the EU and remaining in a relationship with the Republic of Ireland? So it has certainly shifted the debate, just as it has in Scotland, and made the union being preserved less likely. But I don't think a border poll in the immediate future is likely, nor do I actually think Sinn Féin think it's likely.
OK, but there is a provision for it in the Good Friday Agreement.
There absolutely is a provision for it, and the decision is left with the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State would make his decision on what the opinion polls are saying. And the opinion polls do not yet say that there is a majority for a united Ireland. And if you think about it, if you had a referendum and you ended up like the Brexit referendum with a division of 52-48 for a united Ireland, what on earth would that mean in terms of going to a united Ireland? Would the people in the minority accept that change to the status quo? It would be very difficult, and that debate has been very live inside the Republic of Ireland. Do they really want a unified Ireland on that basis with a very large and recalcitrant minority? And that, of course, is where the conflict started in 1919.
Well, let's talk about what's at stake here in the context of Brexit. I mean, are you concerned that there are real security implications if there is a hard border?
I am concerned, or at least the Chief Constable, more importantly than me, is concerned about the security aspects of it. But I do think, root, this is a political rather than a security problem. And the problem is this. The Good Friday Agreement was based on the issue of identity. Well, the problem we had to solve was that nearly half of the people in Northern Ireland think of themselves as Irish, and the slightly bigger majority think of themselves as British. How do we end up with a situation where you can feel British and feel Irish and stay inside of Northern Ireland? And that was only able to happen because we had an open border. The border ceased to exist once both countries joined, both Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom joined the EU. So as long as there's an open border, that issue of identity is fine. You can live in Northern Ireland and you can have an Irish passport. You can do your shopping in Dundalk and you can fly from Dublin. You don't have to interact with the British state at all. You can be Irish or you can be British or you can be both. As soon as we put a hard border back in again, then that problem of identity is reopened and the basis of the Good Friday Agreement is undermined. So then you have a political problem. The security problem is a slightly different one, and that is, as the Chief Constable has pointed out, as soon as you put any sort of installations anywhere near the border, whether on the border or removed from the border, they will be subject to attack. They will be a target for dissident Republicans to attack. And once they start shooting down the cameras, you'll have to put in policemen to defend those cameras. They will start shooting at the policemen. Once the policemen are being shot at, you'll have to put in the army, and we'll be back to where we began. And it's worth remembering, in Northern Ireland, nearly all of the violence has always begun around the border. There have been a series of border campaigns, and that's what we'd be inviting again.
Jonathan Powell. Pilots and cabin crew at one of Europe's biggest airlines, Ryanair, have been told to expect hundreds of job cuts because the company is experiencing a challenging summer and facing a very difficult winter. In a video message to staff, the airline's chief executive, Michael O'Leary, said Ryanair had been hit by the grounding of Boeing's 737 MAX plane, as well as by the possibility of a no-deal Brexit in 12 weeks' time. Our business correspondent Theo Leggett reports.
An apologetic Michael O'Leary painted a grim picture of the environment Ryanair was operating in. Profits had fallen sharply, he said, because of lower fares and higher fuel prices. Staff costs were also up because of new pay deals negotiated with unions last year. Those deals had also caused a reduction in staff turnover, leaving the company with a surplus of 500 pilots and 400 cabin crew. On top of that, he said, the grounding of Boeing's 737 MAX meant Ryanair would have fewer planes than expected next year, and therefore would require fewer crews. And the increased likelihood of a no-deal Brexit, he added, could have a very damaging effect on its business, particularly on routes between the UK and Ireland. All of this meant airport bases would have to be closed and jobs would be lost.
I apologise sincerely to all of you for this bad news and any uncertainty it'll cause you over the coming weeks. But it's being driven by the MAX delivery delays and the threat of a no-deal Brexit, which are clearly huge and very uncertain challenges, which we will try to cope with as best we can while preserving as many jobs as we can.
It's still not clear how many jobs will go or where the impact will be felt. Mr. O'Leary said details were still being finalised, but he warned that some posts would go in September and October, while more cuts would follow after Christmas.
Theo Leggett. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has addressed Ghana's Parliament on the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans landing in North America. She is visiting the country along with 12 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, including the progressive Democrat Ilhan Omar, who has recently been the subject of attacks by President Trump. Thomas Nardi reports from the capital, Accra.
A Ghanaian welcome as the U.S. delegation landed at Kutuka International Airport on Sunday afternoon. This trip has been about what connects the United States and Ghana, friendship, but also a dark past. It is 400 years since the first African slaves were sent across the Atlantic, the start of a trade that will claim millions of lives and shape both countries forever. To pay tribute to these millions, the American delegation visited Elmina Castle along the banks of the Gulf of Guinea. It is here that thousands of people were shackled. Men were beaten and women were raped by colonizers as they waited to be transported across the Atlantic to a life of slavery. Visiting the castle was clearly an emotional experience for the U.S. lawmakers. The Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, told the Ghanaian Parliament she was humbled by what she had seen.
At Cape Coast Castle, we stood before the door of no return, where countless millions caught their last glimpse of Africa before they were shipped to a life of enslavement. Being here has been a transformative experience.
Ghana's President Akufo-Addo has declared 2019 as the year of return and encouraged many of the diaspora people who had been forcibly scattered across the world to come home to stay.
Thomas Nardi in Ghana. The Indian Air Force has launched a new simulator game for mobile devices in a bid to encourage young people to join up. It gives players the chance to try out navigating virtual fighter planes. Electra Naismith has the details.
The Indian Air Force wants you. Its new 3D interactive game allows players to fly fighter jets in aerial combat, with several land targets to choose from. It features a character with a distinctive gunslinger moustache, who bears a striking resemblance to Abhinandan Vardhaman, the fighter pilot who became a national hero in India after being shot down by Pakistan during a dogfight over disputed Kashmir. The game's a clever recruitment tool. A young population and low-cost data have fueled a surge in gaming in India.
Electra Naismith. One of Broadway's most successful directors and producers, Hal Prince, has died at the age of 91. He won 21 Tony Awards and directed productions including Cabaret, Sweeney Todd, Evita and Phantom of the Opera. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at his life.
Hal Prince started out as a stage manager. Before long, he was producing Broadway shows such as, in 1957, West Side Story.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet...
Prince took on the show at the urging of the young lyricist, Stephen Sondheim. Another producer had bailed out, fearing the story and Leonard Bernstein's score lacked commercial appeal. An audition was arranged.
Lenny played the score very loudly because he was nervous, because it was, after all, a very audacious project. Steve sang the lyrics with Lenny, and by the time we'd left, we had decided to produce the show.
But Prince wanted to make the rare transition from producing shows, mainly sorting out the cash, to directing what's on stage. In 1966 came a huge hit, Cabaret.
Welcome and bienvenue, welcome in cabaret, oh cabaret.
In the 70s and 80s, Hal Prince directed six Stephen Sondheim shows, including Company and Sweeney Todd. He'd become what he always wanted to be, the preeminent director of musicals on Broadway.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
But not only on Broadway. When, in London in 1978, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wanted someone to bring Evita to the stage, there could be only one choice. Prince took more Tony Awards in New York than anyone else. When, in his 80s, he worked on a show of greatest hits, it was called with justification Prince of Broadway.
Vinton Dowd on the life of Hal Prince, one of Broadway's most successful directors and producers, who's died at the age of 91. And we'll end with a short extract from Phantom of the Opera.
Slowly, gently, night unfurls its splendor.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. I'm Nick Mars. Until next time, goodbye.
Turn your face away from the garish light of day. Turn your thoughts away.